Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present constitutional attorney John Boniface, who connects the dots between the current investigation into White House disclosure of a CIA agent's identity and the information found in the so-called Downing Street memos. California Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who explains why she introduced a bill that would prohibit the U.S. from establishing military bases in Iraq. And Kim Ives, an editor with the newspaper Haiti Progrès, who discusses the deadly July 6th attack by U.N. soldiers on the Port-au-Prince slum of Cité Soleil. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Despite a peace deal signed on July the 17th between the Indonesian government and the Free Aceh Movement, or GAM, there is still much to be done to end the bloody 30-year war for independence in the Indonesian province of Aceh. Aceh was the worst-hit area in December's Asian tsunami. The deal was brokered over the last few months by Martti Ahtisaari, the former president of Finland. It calls for Indonesia to withdraw 27,000 soldiers and police. In return, the rebels agreed to disarm 5,000 in their ranks. A formal peace treaty is set to be signed on August 15, 2 days before Indonesia's Independence Day. An earlier ceasefire was negotiated in December 2002, but fell apart 6 months later as Indonesia declared martial law in Aceh, a province of 4.3 million people on the northern tip of the island of Sumatra. Over the next 2 years, 3,000 people, mostly civilians, died in the fighting. Aceh was never granted full autonomy and is rich in oil, gas and timber. The agreement calls for 250 European Union observers and 100 monitors from the Association of Southeast Asian Nations to oversee the peace process. On a hot tip in early May, Colombian police followed two retired army officers to a gated community southwest of Bogota. Inside a house, they found 27 crates of arms and 32,000 rounds of ammunition. During surveillance, two more suspects knocked on the door. They were active-duty U.S. soldiers stationed in Colombia. According to The Nation magazine, the guns and ammo were destined for an illegal paramilitary group that the U.S. State Department says is involved in drug trafficking and terrorism. In Washington, State Department spokesman Richard Boucher denied the arms were part of a U.S. covert operation to arm Colombian paramilitary groups. The Colombian Attorney General, who is investigating the case, says the arms were diverted from U.S. stockpiles. TV footage shows U.S. markings on the arms crates. The arms bust came at a sensitive time when Colombian President Alvaro Uribe was negotiating a broad amnesty with right-wing paramilitary groups who are blamed by human rights groups for the murder of peasants, trade union activists, and students. In the 1960s, Washington encouraged the Colombian army to establish paramilitary units to fight leftist rebels. Yet, by the late 1980s, the paramilitaries were knee-deep in drug trafficking and declared illegal. The Center for Public Integrity reports that a new, loosely regulated 527 group, the Alaska to America Energy Initiative, was set up last year to lobby for the opening of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR, for oil and gas development. Funded with $15,000 from energy lobbyists and oil companies, the group has so far only paid for the trip by Chris Noss, Alaska Governor Frank Murkowski's policy director, to last November's meeting of the Republican Governors Association in New Orleans. At the meeting, Noss pressed the governors to pass a resolution to open up ANWR to oil development, but the resolution failed to pass. The fate of ANWR may rest with the federal energy legislation now being considered. A bill passed by the House of Representatives called for oil development in the wilderness area, while the Senate version did not. To prevent a deadlock on the energy bill, congressional Republicans may put the ANWR provision in a separate bill. Noss's trip, reimbursed by the 527 group, caused some controversy in Alaska. The State Ethics Commission, after an inquiry made by the Center for Public Integrity, reclassified the trip as official rather than personal. The gift of paid expenses was classified as a gift to the state of Alaska. Among the top contributors to the Alaska to America energy initiatives are lobbyist Sam Keto, who represents two oil companies seeking to drill in Anwar, and Patton Boggs lobbyist Robert Evans, who represents two major natural gas companies, Calpine Corporation and Evergreen Resources. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
The involvement of President Bush's closest advisor, Karl Rove, in leaking information about the identity of a covert CIA agent to at least two reporters has set off a political firestorm in Washington, with the White House alternately refusing to comment and employing surrogates to attack the president's critics. Among the targets of these attacks is former U.S. Ambassador Joseph Wilson, whose wife Valerie Plame is the subject of a federal investigation looking into who in the White House revealed her identity as an undercover CIA officer working on weapons of mass destruction issues. Wilson was initially attacked by members of the Bush administration after he wrote an opinion editorial in the New York Times recounting his investigation into an Iraq nuclear connection while on a trip to Niger for the CIA in 2002. In Niger, Wilson found that contrary to White House assertions, Saddam Hussein's regime was not seeking uranium there for a nuclear weapons program. Despite Wilson's conclusion, the president made the claim in his January 2003 State of the Union address. At its core, the Wilson-Plame-Rove case revolves around the Bush administration's effort to construct a dubious rationale for the war in Iraq. That case is bolstered by the Downing Street memos, a series of minutes from meetings of high British government officials in 2002 that indicates that the Bush administration intended to invade Iraq, justified by intelligence and facts that were being fixed around the policy. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Boniface, constitutional attorney and co-founder of AfterDowningStreet.org, who connects the dots between revelations found in these two cases and explains why he is advocating for a formal congressional investigation that could lead to impeachment proceedings against President Bush.
I think what comes from the Downing Street memos is a clear showing that the president may have been part of an overall deception campaign to deceive and mislead the United States Congress and the American people. And that evidence, demonstrated by Sir Richard Dearlove's briefing to Prime Minister Tony Blair. Mr. Dearlove was at the time of the Downing Street meeting on July 23, 2002, the head of MI6, which is the equivalent of our Central Intelligence Agency. And he was briefing Prime Minister Tony Blair and his other top national security officials on meetings that he, Mr. Dearlove, had just had in Washington with senior U.S. government officials. And he reports back to the British government that President Bush had already decided by July 2002 to invade Iraq, and that the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy. I can think of no higher crime for a president to commit under our Constitution than the crime of sending the nation into war based on a potential lie, to send young men and women off to their death based on fraudulent claims. And so what we have done with AfterDowningStreet.org is launch this national grassroots effort to demand the truth. Did the president engage in this conspiracy? Did he lie to the nation and to the United States Congress? And if so, should we not hold him accountable for that government misconduct?
John Boniface, could you comment for us on the revelations in the Valerie Plame, Karl Rove case that provides evidence against the Bush administration for deliberately misleading the American people on the threat posed by Iraq and the intersection of that information with the Downing Street memos?
Well, the story here really begins, of course, with the deception campaign that began prior to the invasion of Iraq, and Ambassador Joe Wilson's trip to Niger to determine whether or not it was true that Niger had engaged in a purported sale or attempted sale of uranium to Iraq. Ambassador Wilson was sent in 2002 to determine the validity of this claim. He came back. He reported back to the Bush administration that it was a highly doubtful claim, and yet the words ended up in the President's State of the Union address in 2003 that this claim was somehow valid and that Iraq was seeking uranium. All of that obviously led to this invasion and the threat of a mushroom cloud coming over the United States from Iraq if, in fact, we did not invade Iraq. So that's the backdrop to why we have now an investigation into whether or not the Bush administration intentionally outed a covert CIA operative, Mr. Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame Wilson, in such a way that clearly would have been illegal. And they did so, if they in fact engage in this, because they were trying to exact retribution against Mr. Wilson for having blown their cover, for having demonstrated that the president and his top advisors may have engaged in this deception campaign about the war. So all this is very much connected, and I think what the special counsel Patrick Fitzgerald does in that case will have a rippling effect on the overall case for why we need a full investigation on the president's conduct leading up to this war.
Is the information contained in the Downing Street memos directly related in some respect to things that are uncovered in the Valerie Plame Karl Rove case?
Well, I think the evidence of the Downing Street memos that shows that the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy connects very clearly with what Ambassador Wilson said on the op-ed pages of the New York Times in July of 2003, and for which he faced this retaliation effort by the Bush administration. So I think that they are very much connected. But I do think that we have to expand beyond the sole question of whether or not one or more Bush administration officials were engaged in outing a covert CIA operative to the larger scandal that has involved the deaths of over 1,700 United States soldiers, tens of thousands of Iraqi civilians, and that's the scandal of this illegal war, and whether the president deceived the nation and the U.S. Congress in sending the nation into this war. You know, no one can fully predict where any of this will go, but what we can say is that we have a role to play as citizens around the country in standing up and being heard, in pressuring our members of Congress to do the right thing, to have the courage to demand the truth, and to protect and uphold the Constitution. And I really do believe that history will judge us to be right, and whether the proceedings on impeachment will take place during the time of this administration, you know, remains to be seen. But I think the pressure is clearly building for there to be an accountability for all that has gone on with respect to this war and with respect to the administration's role in this war.
That was John Bonifaz, constitutional attorney and co-founder of the campaign to investigate the Downing Street memos. Visit his group's website at www.afterdowningstreet.org. California Congresswoman Barbara Lee, the only member of Congress to vote against authorizing President Bush to respond militarily to the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, has initiated two recent actions in the House of Representatives that further solidifies her role as a leading opponent of the Bush administration's foreign policy. On June 30th, Lee introduced a bill that states it is the policy of the United States not to enter into any base agreements with the government of Iraq that would lead to a permanent United States military presence in Iraq. The bill currently has 41 co-sponsors. Lee, who co-chairs the Progressive Caucus in the House, is also circulating a letter to her colleagues asking them to sign onto a resolution of inquiry into the Downing Street memo, with the goal of learning whether steps were being taken by the Bush administration to fix intelligence and facts around a decision to go to war. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Representative Lee about these two measures and the growing opposition to the war in Iraq across the nation and in Congress.
Basically, what my resolution does is just codify what the president and the administration have been saying. It's very important that the American people know and that the Iraqi people know that the United States does not plan to enter into any permanent military base agreement. And we're attempting to move this forward in a very aggressive way. Hopefully, we'll build more co-sponsor support. I think 41 co-sponsors within a couple of weeks is phenomenal. I think there's a general sense here on both sides of the aisle that the cost, first of all, in terms of a military presence in Iraq would be billions of dollars, that it would not provide for regional security and stability, and the questions about why the United States would want a permanent base in Iraq or permanent bases in Iraq are questions that have to be answered. And so I think this resolution will finally get the administration, if they support the resolution, to put it in writing.
Are there any Republicans among the 41 co-sponsors of the bill?
I think one Republican, but I'm talking about discussion of the issue around no permanent bases. When we were in, I'm on the International Relations Committee, and during the markup of the State Department authorization bill, I offered the same resolution as an amendment to that bill, and I believe there were three Republicans that voted for it then. So it's a general feel, I believe, that that those issues need to be fleshed out. And so we definitely intend to build bipartisan support.
I've read, despite all the statements from President Bush and top administration officials, that they're not going to build permanent bases. I've also read a number of things that refer to indications that they are building bases, even now, that those are the plans. Can you speak to that?
I've heard those rumors. We know this administration has very little credibility when it comes to their rhetoric, because they have misled the world in so many ways on so many occasions. And what my resolution wants to do and will do is put the administration on record in support of this in a law that says that we're not going to have any permanent bases. I've been very disappointed that they haven't wanted to come forward and introduce their own legislation so that the Congress wouldn't have to really worry about doing it. Would be very clear in saying this is something they want, we want it codified. So I think what we're going to do will really help them live up to their public state.
I also wanted to ask you about your resolution of inquiry to look into the information in what's been called the Downing Street memo to see whether intelligence was fixed around the policy of going to war in Iraq. Your resolution hasn't been introduced yet?
This is something we're working on with many members of Congress, and I think the bottom line is a resolution of inquiry is very important because Congress has the duty and responsibility to provide oversight and to ask the tough questions with regard to how we got into this war and how we're going to end this war. Too many of our young men and women have died, countless Iraqi civilians. Iraq has become now a hotbed for terrorism, so there are many more national security questions and issues that we have to address. And the basic questions that we're asking, the American people have a right to know.
Do you think these bills and resolutions that you're introducing, along with others by some of your fellow members of Congress, such as the one by Representative Dennis Kucinich and others, to set a target date for withdrawal from Iraq, that this is reflecting a growing uneasiness on the part of the American people and members of Congress with the war and with the administration's policies on how they're handling the war?
Well, I think the American people, you've been reading these polls, are really fed up with it. They don't believe the president. They wanted to, but they don't. Many of us knew early on that this war was not a war that needed to be fought. We knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction. We told them that. We knew that Iraq did not pose an imminent danger and threat to the United States, and we told them that. Now I believe what's going on is people are at their wits' end. The American people. They're seeing too many young people losing their lives behind the distortions and the lies that were told. And I think that the resolutions that we're offering provide a focus and provide the public with a way to know and to understand that there are some of us here who are with them and who believe that inside of the House of Representatives, we need to ensure that their voice is heard and that the appropriate policies are introduced and passed that would help begin to bring our young men and women home.
That was Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who was nominated in late June for the Nobel Peace Prize as part of an international effort to recognize the work of women around the world who promote peace. For more information on Lee's work in Congress, call her office at area code 202-225-2661 or visit her website at www.house.gov/Lee. On the morning of July 6th, more than 350 United Nations peacekeeping troops deployed in Haiti raided the densely populated Port-au-Prince slum of Cité Soleil. A UN spokesperson, Colonel Elouffé Boubar, stated that the operation was aimed at armed gangs that they say are responsible for rampant violence in the Haitian capital. But residents of the poor neighborhood, many of whom are staunch supporters of ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, say that UN troops, backed by tanks and helicopters, shot indiscriminately, killing at least 23 and as many as 60 civilians. UN officials reported only 5 killed. Among those slain in the raid was Emmanuel Jred Wilme, known as a pro-Aristide community leader in Cité Soleil and branded as a dangerous gang leader by the U.S.-installed interim Haitian government and the UN. Haiti has been plagued by violence and instability since an armed rebellion by former Haitian soldiers toppled Aristide's government in February 2004. Aristide, now in exile in South Africa, maintains that he was kidnapped and forced to leave Haiti as Washington and Paris orchestrated the coup against him. The 7,400-member UN peacekeeping force, made up of soldiers from Brazil, Peru, Jordan, and Uruguay, is preparing for presidential, parliamentary, and local elections in October and December. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Kim Ives, an editor with the newspaper Haiti Progrès, who describes the deadly July 6th attack by UN soldiers on Cité Soleil and the prospects for free and fair elections later this year.
It was one of the most horrific massacres since the coup began on February 29, 2004, when U.S. Special Forces soldiers flew into Haiti on an unmarked jet, as they do. We're learning more and more about that these days, about the Special Forces going and kidnapping and snatching people off the streets. But they went into Haiti and they snatched the president out of his home, surrounded the place with laser sighted rifles and machine guns, and took him to the airport and flew him out to Africa. And there have been quite a few massacres since that time, but the one that occurred on the 6th of July in Cité Soleil stands out for two reasons. One, it was 60 people that was killed in the space of about 4 or 5 hours by a total assault, 350 troops, 2 helicopter gunships, tanks firing on homes. I mean, this was an assault on a civilian population. Secondly, it was carried out by the United Nations only. They weren't even using the Haitian police, who they've been backing up over these past months. They carried out the operation themselves. So this is really a new stage in the UN taking control of the military occupation of Haiti, not even using Haitian proxies. Another irony was that this happened on the same day as the London bombings. You know, I really think that the parallels are pretty striking. In London, you know, we see how many miles of print and videotape that have been spent on that, and Haiti is practically... This is considered a non-story when 60 people are killed.
Now, that figure of 60 people, has that figure of the death toll in this particular attack on July 6th that's been admitted to or corroborated by the United Nations?
No. The United Nations claims that 5 or 6 people were killed. We had pictures in Haiti Progress this week on the cover, for example, of a woman called Sonia Romulus, who was a 22-year-old mother of a child, Nelson Romulus. The UN troops came into her home, threw a smoke grenade in, started firing. One of the bullets went right through her, killed her, and killed her 1-year-old infant that was in her arms. Then they shot her 4-year-old son, Stanley Romulus, in the head. This would be 3 of the 6 bandits that the UN claimed were killed. Unfortunately for the UN, there was a labor delegation which was on hand there, which went in and videotaped the carnage that took place. They went in and videotaped the churches and the schools and the tin and cardboard shacks that were riddled with machine gun bullets. This was a total assault on a community which has been assaulted and besieged for the past 5-6 months on repeated occasions. So the UN is trying to talk it down and cover it up, but the fact is we got the testimony, we have the videotape, we have the proof that there was a massacre that took place that day.
Well, Kim, what's been the response in Haiti? I know hundreds, if not thousands, came to the funeral of some of those who were killed in this July 6th attack by UN forces. But are there calls for investigations both inside and outside Haiti in response to what occurred on July 6th?
There is a major effort now to put together an international tribunal on Haiti, which will be held in Washington on the 23rd of September. This will be a tribunal where the evidence of these massacres, of the U.S. role in the coup, will be put forth, and this will be the night before the big September 24th demonstration in Washington. So we want to prepare a dossier which can go to the International Criminal Court, who can then put warrants out for these U.N. officials who are ordering these massacres.
Tell us a little bit about the problems with the upcoming elections and the view of the Lavalas Family Party in participation.
At this point, of the 4.5 million eligible voters, something less than 4% have obtained their electoral card. Basically, the deadlines are hurtling at the UN occupation forces, and the National Popular Party, along with a number of the Lavalas Family Party base organizations, have distributed a flyer nationwide encouraging people not to go take what they call this poison electoral card, saying that this would be playing into the hands of the people who did the February 29th kidnapping, and that they would have an election which would be totally rigged by the computers.
That was Kim Ives, an editor with the newspaper Haiti Progrès. Contact Haiti Progrès by calling area code 718-434-8100 or visit their website at www.haitiprogres.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anon, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.